We have been discussing for the last couple of days, having extended discussion of the jhanas, of the first four meditative states in this process of leading towards awakening. Just to recapitulate, as we should always recapitulate, because repetition helps the mind. In first jhana, we have, of course, the gladness, our metta, sending that feeling of metta to the spiritual friend. This creates gladness. When we use the six R's and we relax and let go of an unwholesome mental state, which is a hindrance, and feel the relief that that brings, that is also a basis of pamoja, of gladness. And so as our mind stays rested in this gladness for a certain length of time, we have rapture, piti, arising. Rapture arises again as movement, as an energetic movement of delight going through us somewhere in the body, maybe flowing from or bubbling from the metta, the gladness we feel in the chest. But in the first jhana, we also have this constant evaluation and commentary on the meditation, partially because the piti is a stronger factor in the first jhana, and it distracts us. It throws us off the object of meditation, and we constantly have to bring our attention back using the six R's. So in that sense, in addition to thinking and evaluating, initial and sustained application to the object of meditation, the later understanding of vitaka vichara is not incorrect. So we can have a full understanding of vitaka vichara that embraces both the sutta idea of just thinking and evaluating, and the later idea of reapplying ourselves to the wholesome object, third part of right effort, and then maintaining our attention on that wholesome object, the loving kindness. So with the second jhana, we have piti sukha born of samadhi. And as we talked about yesterday, samadhi is not present in the first jhana. What does that mean? It means that if we are looking for a calm, collected, tranquil experience, it's not to be found in the first jhana. We should lower our expectations. Well, we should have no expectations, but it's natural that we will have expectations, right? But we should lower our expectations of the first jhana. The first jhana is an ordeal. But if we are able to follow the instructions to 6R when we are off the object of meditation, we maybe can use the trick of sending even the piti, this movement, to the spiritual friend along with the metta. Our mind eventually settles and unifies. And this is piti sukha born of samadhi, which has a different character. The piti sukha born of samadhi, rather than intruding on us from without, wells up from within us. And this is exemplified by the jhana similes, right? So we have the rain of the piti sukha on the dry, desiccated dust, the flower. And the dry, desiccated dust is our ordinary mode of thinking and experiencing through the sixfold base, liable to be stirred up by even the slightest wind, scattered. And the piti sukha rains, and it still is something like rain that makes contact with us and appears to come from without. So there's still some disturbance in it. But this piti sukha moistens, brings together the flour, the soap powder, rain to the desert, whatever kind of simile you would like. But that's the action of it. So in the second jhana, this piti sukha is welling from within and filling. So it's not intrusive. We've gone within. And that's why the accompanying factor, which is internal confidence coming from within, pasadi, tranquility, rises within from this soothing flow that's filling us, filling our awareness. And we can send this internal flow of Pitisukha to our spiritual friend, and we will notice that the feeling of metta and the feeling of this flow of Pitisukha are very compatible and will unify. This is the unification of mind, Chetaso Ekodibhava, an accompanying factor of the second jhana. The mind is brought to peace by this confidence in the teaching, this confidence in ourselves, because here in the second jhana, we see the meditation coming together. We see our consciousness change. We are in an altered state of consciousness. And instead of really feeling like we are standing in the midst of the buzzing and the blooming, looking at this show that seems to be very disturbing, in the second jhana, this relief really arises of it really coming together. And to a certain extent, the state holds us. It's a place that we can rest. Instead of trying to maintain our recollection of the instruction through mindfulness and really juggling many factors, we get some relief because this is a home. This is a home for the mind. This is a place where we can gain some rest, some peace. As we remain in that state and we have that peace and we relish and enjoy that peace, that tranquility, and we share it with our spiritual friend, right? As I said last night, if you share something, it flows. So more of it has to come for you to share. This is very important. This is revealed in the Tibetan Tonglen practice, which I have mentioned, where you have a visualization of a great guru, a great teacher, who you think is very pure, radiating loving kindness to you. You receive it with puja, you receive it reverentially, and you begin to be filled with it, and then you have the spiritual friend or the groups of beloved ones, neutral ones, ones that are maybe not so beloved in front of you, and you send it to them, and you're sort of the node in this circuit of loving kindness. And so both receiving and sending at the same time. This is what happens too in the second jhana. So you can rest in that and really feel the joy, really feel the joy here. This is a place of refreshment. This is a place of ecstasy. The spiritual states are often called ecstasies for this very reason. As you remain in this state, sending the Pitisukha, the joy, the flow that's welling up from within to your spiritual friend, and keep your attention on that, and 6R, anything that pulls your attention away, although far fewer things will pull your attention away from this, you will notice that the movement appears to be a little intrusive. And if it takes you off the spiritual friend, you start 6R-ing even the movement, even the flow begins to become a disturbance. What was once soothing becomes a disturbance. This is said in the suttas in the Book of Nines, in the Anguttara Nikaya, the Book of Nines. Even the state that we have achieved, we begin to see the disturbing quality of it. This is insight, right? Even these ecstatic states have imperfections in them, have places that are not complete rest, that are disturbing to the mind, that take us off the object of meditation. And so we 6R, and we stay with the feeling of tranquility, and eventually, on its own, without pushing, of course, allowing everything to be there, the PT will just fall away, leaving a perfect flood of sukha. No welling up from within, no raining from without, no channels leading in. And we are, as it were, drenched, submerged in this sukha. I'll read to you the description of the third jhana. Again, monks, with the fading away as well of rapture, a monk abides in equanimity and mindful and fully aware, still feeling pleasure, sukha, with the body. He enters upon and abides in the third jhana, on account of which noble ones announce, he has a pleasant abiding who has equanimity and is mindful. So when we read the Aranyavibhanga Sutta 139, when we studied that together, the Buddha talked about the jhanas as, of course, the wholesome pleasure that should be pursued, that should not be feared, that should be cultivated. And he said, this is the bliss of renunciation, the bliss of seclusion, the bliss of peace, the bliss of enlightenment. So here we are talking about the bliss of peace, being perfectly at peace in the third jhana. This is bliss. And we feel this bliss with the body. Why do we feel it with the body? Because the body needs to feel it. The body stores, as we've said, all of these tensions and tightnesses, all of our, it's our repository of our mental and emotional blockages. Actually, the body is a mental and emotional blockage. It's composed of mental blockage. The very matter of the body is drawn together and held together by these mental blockages that we have. If we look at dependent origination, this makes perfect sense. The mental intention goes forward and we take on nama rupa. We take on rupa. We fashion for ourselves a vehicle that matches our mental state, and then proceed to eat and consume with that body to sustain it and do all sorts of things. But if we hear the teachings of letting go, if we hear the teachings of six R-ing, of right effort, we can undo a lot of that. And it begins with undoing our mental blockages. So here in the third jhana, the body feels the sukha, divested of rapture, and is submerged in it and sort of marinates in it and is soothed by it. And all of the tensions in the body are relaxed. We melt into the sukha. The simile is very instructive. Once again, he makes the pleasure divested of rapture, drench, steep, fill, and pervade this body, so that there is no part of the whole body unpervaded by the pleasure divested of rapture. Just as in a pond of blue or red or white lotuses, some lotuses that are born and grow in the water thrive immersed in the water without rising out of it, and cool water drenches, steeps, fills, and pervades them from tips to their roots, so that there is no part of all those lotuses unpervaded by cool water. So too a monk makes the pleasure divested of rapture drench, steep, fill, and pervade the body, so that there is no part of this whole body unpervaded by the pleasure divested of rapture. So when this happens, we are perfectly aware. Why are we perfectly aware? Because we don't have the thoughts intruding. We don't have the gross emotions of the body intruding. They are melted away. And so what that leaves is a pure mind that is balanced, steady, equanimous, a pure mind that is fully aware, meaning that it can experience a contact without, in a gross sense, reacting to it. And so full awareness means the object is seen as the object without our intrusion upon it, with our I like it, I don't like it. This gets deeper. This is not full awakening, of course, but this is the bliss of awakening. There's only one imperfection of purity left, and that is, of course, the sukha that's in the body. But the sukha is doing a job, as I've said. The sukha is purifying us from our gross tensions, the emotions that are connected to the body. That is the point of the third jhana, to achieve this purification so that we can let go. Here we will notice that we can stay on the object of meditation for a very long time. And when a distraction pulls us off the object of meditation, it's very easy to just gently use the six R's and go back. It's very interesting that many who are critical of the jhanas say that when one is in jhana, one is not mindful and fully aware. Yet this is a component of the state, this mindfulness and this full awareness. When we have brought relief to the mind and to the body, that is when we can be mindful and fully aware. When we don't, as it said, have a dog in this game, we can see things as they really are.
So is the sukha more of a peripheral phenomena that you're kind of clued into, but like really focusing more on more of like the metta as your primary object? Or is it connected and infused with the metta in the same way as the jhana is connected to the pitti?
Yes. So if metta were one thing and the sukha were another, then the mind isn't unified. And the unification of mind has occurred in the second jhana. So it's one beautiful feeling that's pervading the body that one is sharing with a spiritual friend. Even the radiating quality changes in the third jhana. This is why radiating, or whatever verb you want to use for sharing, is so important, because the radiating, the way that we're radiating changes. In the second jhana, we're radiating and it's a flow to the spiritual friend. Here, the spiritual friend is submerged with us. They are with us in this perfect lake of sukha, divested of any kind of movement. The synonym for the third jhana is contentment. We have everything we want, and so we are content.
Last night, when you were talking about radiance, I believe that you indicated, and I could have misheard this, that this should wait until you're further on, this the notion of the six directions, that beautiful guided meditation that Bhante gave, yes, bows to you many times over. Should we wait until we're further down the jhana track to do that kind of directional radiation and stay with the friend up through the fourth jhana? Or do you have a feeling on when to start doing that?
Yes, we do that radiation when the body is tranquilized. The body is well on its way to tranquilization in the third jhana, but it's not fully tranquilized. We still have a pretty heavy bodily sense in the third jhana, but it's blissful. It's just a bliss body. It becomes more difficult to identify certain parts of the body in the third jhana because we're in this undifferentiated sukha. But as this deepens, the third jhana being a transition state of deepening to equanimity, to deeper equanimity, if we radiate with a gross sense of the body being there, then we're going to encounter the problem that another student encountered where it felt like their body was stretching in one direction. We can't radiate in the six directions while we have this localized bodily sense because we're bounded by the body. When the bodily sense has disappeared or is mostly disappeared, then we radiate in the six directions because we're capable of it, because then our experience is of pure energy, unbounded by physicality.
I have two questions. The first is, I know that Bhante said at some point this week that the PT never really goes away entirely leading up to awakening. How does that reconcile with the total disappearance of PT in the third jhana?
So PT, as a jhanic factor, is a species of the awakening factor of PT, rapture. And the seven factors of awakening are sequential. They are a chain of causation, but they are a circular chain of causation because mindfulness becomes purified by equanimity. So we have them repeating through this process on a non-meditative level. We have the seven factors of awakening turning through our process when we are engaged in right view and right intention and the moral discipline. We still have, on a very subtle level, especially when we see that the moral discipline actually is there for a purpose, when we're confirmed in these propositions by our direct experience that they're true, there is a joy that comes up. Not a jhanic joy necessarily, although it can be, but there is a joy or a rapture that comes up. Our state of mind has changed a little bit and is uplifted. That's the action of PT. So that happens even, can happen even before we are in the jhanas. Then in the jhanas, we have PT arising as a factor in the jhanas, and we cycle through, again, the seven factors of awakening. The seven factors are now functioning more deeply, and then they continue. So all of the seven factors of awakening are turning ever deeper, like a drill, or I don't like the word drill, like an auger. So it turns like an auger. It's circular, but it also comes to a point. It has to, because samsara is circular, and it has a gravity to it. So we need to also have a method of escape that is circular, but is coming to a point that is able to pierce through samsara, pierce through the circular, emerge. It said in the insight path, the insight leading to emergence. We are emerging from samsara, and we need to sort of poke through, but obeying the rules of samsara while we're in it, which are circular. So we encounter PT in its various forms throughout the path.
So if you had non-jhana PT in the third jhana, are you like in the third jhana and like on the path to move to the fourth? There's like PT anywhere in the realm of experience. You're not yet in the third jhana.
So these are practices, again, not perfections. And so there will be imperfections in all of these states. They're not going to be as written, fully perfected, where we are perfecting them. And if we have a longer retreat, a 30-day retreat instead of a 10-day retreat, you know, think of how calm everybody is now. Now, what if we stayed here another 2 weeks? What if we stayed here another month, 6 months? These jhanas are going to be very deep indeed. So we should remember that in the jhanas, PT is movement. It's identified in the jhana similes as movement. First reigning, intrusive, right, coming from without, then welling up from within, and then quietly coming to a stop and leaving just sukha. So if we still have the reigning on us, well, we have a little intrusion. So we siksar, and then we can go back to a state that's maybe more like the third jhana, more like the definition. Don't be so married to, am I in the state and is it perfect? The object of meditation is not the jhana. The object of meditation is the Brahma-vihara. The jhana is our background mental state that we have the Brahma-vihara in. Let's let Bhante respond to that question. Do you have anything to add?
Describing his awakening in India, for example, the story. He's sitting at the root of the Bo tree, sitting cross-legged in one posture, enjoying the bliss of liberation for 7 days. Just saying. I think it's still there. But it's subtle. It's just that, like, this it's enjoyable, you know, in the more advanced stages, when even radiating equanimity, it feels good. It's not unpleasant, no. It feels good anyways, it's just really calm. And actually the mind likes that more and more. So, and I like, because I translate the Bojangas as supports of awakening, and I take that from a sutta where the Buddha says that each support, each of the Bojangas, is like a rafter of a peak roof, all pointing to the top, like they're all pointing to Nibbana. So. And I agree with what Rachel said.
Did you want to ask your follow-up?
The follow-up may have been answered. It's I think I've heard other teachers talk about how it can be hard to turn BT off, and times in which it's been really unclear to me whether and how to move on from just flowing the metta, because the flowing metta PT Sukha thing never changes. That is like the underlying motivation behind understanding. I think I don't feel particularly attached to understanding the perfect definition of state and whether or not I'm in that state. I want to make sure I'm doing the technique right.
We don't turn anything off. We relax and let it do its thing, keeping our attention on the object of meditation. So the more that there's the vacuum cleaner is running somewhere. The more we learn to rest with the object of meditation, we can notice the qualities that are happening with the object of meditation, the flow, that it's flooding towards the spiritual friend rather than flowing, that it seems to be more still. Still some movement in there, but relatively speaking, the mind isn't 100% restful, because even the sukha starts to become a disturbance. The mind wants to go deeper. But we shouldn't direct the meditation and shut anything off. Just 6R, come back to the object of meditation, and the quality of it flowing will change on its own. We don't have to change it. So these are markers to know where we are. But in the meditation, we don't need to necessarily know where we are. We just need to stay with the object of meditation. But the advice I gave yesterday on what to do before we get up off the cushion, that comes from the Venerable Ayakkema, which is to recapitulate, what did I learn in this meditation? And there we can review where we were. And in reviewing where we were and having the vocabulary for these states, we can maybe start making the connections between these states and what's changing and why it's changing. And this is where a lot of insight comes in. We understand, the first jhana is not unified and is disturbing. Thought is disturbing. Thoughts are disturbing. That is revealed to us by the second jhana, when thoughts go away or are very strongly diminished and are not always present and are easily let go of when they intrude. And then the insight from the third jhana is that movement is disturbing, because PT has a lot of movement, energetic movement in it. And so movement is disturbing, stillness desirable.
Movement in that, you're not radiating that. So your spiritual friend is more within in you with that state of equanimity rather than energy radiating.
Equanimity in the third jhana is not an object of meditation. It's the loving kindness starts to be purified by equanimity. When the loving kindness is flowing, it's very energetic and it's joyful. And a lot of movement. So the more equanimous is for it to become more still. And so the equanimity is really describing the character of the feeling that we have of loving kindness rather than the feeling itself. So we're not radiating that equanimity, we're still radiating metta. It's just the gentleness, the looking on, as Bhante said, the looking on rather than really being in it because it's flowing, just the looking on, the flood of sukha. It's not flowing anymore, it's still, and just observing and having that observation liberated from the impingement of movement.
So you're saying it's still the irradiating of measure, but it's very soft?
It's more still, it's flooding out. So the difference between, it doesn't have to be this strong, but let a garden hose and a flood of metta. You can flood your flower bed with water by turning the hose on, you know, very low and letting the water kind of half trickle out of the hose, and it kind of floods into the garden bed, doesn't get on the leaves, so we don't have rot happening. So the third jhana is flooding the garden rather than spraying it. Sure. Yes. First, we have sati, normally translated mindfulness, although in the seven factors, it's recollection. The definition of the enlightenment factor of mindfulness is recalling the Dhamma. But sati, mindfulness. Then we have investigation into states, Dhamma vichaya. And that is, do you want me to give definition? I'll just give the chain. So we have mindfulness. We have investigation into dhammas, discernment, and we have energy, virya, and then we have piti, and then we have tranquility, and then we have samadhi, proper samadhi, unified mind, and then we have equanimity. And then in the fourth jhana, it said mindfulness is purified by equanimity. And so we have more equanimous mindfulness, and then we have all of the rest of the factors imbued by the equanimity that we've achieved, and it goes through and deepens.
Can you describe the second, or define the second one, the investigation aspect?
The mindfulness awakening factor is recalling the Dhamma. We have to know what to do. We have to know what is right view, and we have to know what is right intention. The discernment is whatever arises compared to the Dhamma. Is it wholesome or is it unwholesome? That's our main investigation. Is it onward leading to disenchantment, dispassion, freedom, nibbana? Or is it something that is tying our consciousness to sensuality, to craving for being, to ignorance? Seeing whether something is impermanent, therefore suffering, therefore not fit to be called a self. So seeing the movement and seeing the irritation that movement brings about, and therefore not worth calling myself or identifying with, because you identify with something that's movement and suffering at your peril. And even when you say it out loud, identifying with suffering, is that something you want to do? No. So that's the investigation. I was going to give a talk on the seven factors, but we're moving through the jhanas very thoroughly. That's okay.
I just wanted to make sure, are these causes in the sense that like I can tweak them a little bit, like hold too much energy, maybe back down?
Are we talking about the seven factors?
Yes.
Bhante. Yeah.
Well, there's that's the things that there's so many ways of working with those things. So, but usually if you understand right effort properly and Dhamma Vichaya, then that's all you need to do. Then the rest will just arise on its own. Usually.
Follow-up question to what you just said. You mentioned if you understand right effort properly, could you like
the properly part. Actually, in this book, on page 152, if you want how they work. It's part of Apanasati Sutta, which I call remembering the breath. If you have questions about how the seven supports of awakening work, this is the best place I can to look for that answer. It really explains quite well how it all proceeds. And as for your properly, I think just the 6 hours, and that's it. That's all you need to know. And I guess just the thing is, when people try to make something happen, is usually because there's not enough joy. And when there's joy, this whole process happens automatically. And when you try to get into it and to kind of make it, then the joy fades away, and then you try to make it even more, and then that's when the problems start.
So I'll share with you a story on the energy awakening factor that I think illustrates what Bhante just said. I think it's already been mentioned, though not directly, about the cautionary tale of the Bhikkhu Sona. So the Bhikkhu Sona, young bhikkhu, very much like the Buddha, well-to-do, raised delicately, very delicately, so delicately, in fact, that it said that he had little cilia, fine hairs growing from the soles of his feet. He was very determined to become awakened, very inspired by the Buddha. And so he had his hermitage and his walking meditation path, and he was applying so much effort to the meditation, to the walking meditation, that his feet were bleeding. And so he thought to himself, maybe this isn't for me. Maybe I'll do better if I go back and assume my Dhamma role as a son who will inherit the wealth and maintain the family business, and I can support the Dhamma like Anathapindika did with my wealth. Well, the Buddha, it said, perceived this idea in the Bhikkhu Sona with his divine ear. And so he went to the hermitage and he said to the Bhikkhu Sona, "Why is it that this walking path looks like the slaughterhouse of cattle?" And then Sona shared his practice and his doubts about the practice, because it hurt, because his feet were bleeding and he wasn't getting anywhere with all that pain. And so the Buddha gave him a simile, knowing that he was an aristocrat and would have been trained in music. So he said, "Monk, were you schooled on how to play the veena, the guitar?" And the monk said, "Oh yes, of course, I was schooled on how to play the veena." And the Buddha said, "When you played the veena, if the strings of the veena were too tight, was it tuneful? Did it make a good sound?" Sona said, "No." And then the Buddha said, "If the strings of the veena were too weak, was it tuneful? Did it make a good sound?" "No." "That's right, monk. The effort should be like the strings of the veena, neither too tight nor too loose, and attuned to the pitch of the spiritual faculties." People forget that part, and that is the secret. We all know too much effort is bad, too little effort, bad, not going anywhere. But we have to be in tune with the spiritual faculties. And what is one of the spiritual faculties that's not obviously in meditation? Sada, confidence. How do we gain confidence in playing a musical instrument? How do we do that? How do we gain confidence in dancing? We gain confidence in playing a musical instrument or in dancing because we are mindful of the pleasure of it. When we listen to the sound that we're making, or we get lost in the dance, we feel joy. This joy gives us confidence, and that makes our effort joyful. That makes our effort correct. So it's not just this case of balancing, just like the middle way. People think it's like a balance, like a Greek moderation thing, right? It's not just balanced. It has to be joyful or else we're not confident. And if we're not confident, we're insecure. We're not cool. Really cool people, the essence of being cool is being secure. There's nothing more uncool than being insecure, right? That is the definition of being uncool. When we talk about Nibbana, and we talk about growing cool right there, we talk about ultimate security, ultimate letting go. And so we need to become cool. We need to become confident. We're not there to prove anything to anybody. We're not there to show anybody anything. We're not there to get it right. We're there to find security. Kima, a synonym for enlightenment. So we have to have this security that's born of listening to what we're doing and finding its joy. And the joy will lead us in a direction towards confidence.
Yeah, I have one comment. This is my own discovery. It's like, that's why you should not lie. Because the more you lie, the harder it becomes to trust yourself. So to build up that confidence becomes more difficult. The less you lie, the easier it becomes to become one of the cool kids.
That's right. But real security comes from internal confidence, joy. We have to have that joy. We have to be able to rest and say, I'm stable because I'm satisfied. I'm fulfilled. I'm contented. Anything else? Yes, that's revealed by the seven factors of awakening. So the last four of the factors of awakening, so if we follow the Bhikkhu Sona and he has the right kind of energy, it's infused with Pamoja, gladness, so he hears the sound of the Veena, and he's glad that it's produced a good sound, and that guides his fingers, and he becomes sort of unified into it and becomes rapturous. And then rapture leads to tranquility. Tranquility leads to, there's a sort of step there of contentment, but included in samadhi, unification of mind, and then equanimity. And with that equanimity, we are more mindful and able to see more deeply. When we see deeply, when we have an insight, it's joyful. There are no hard truths on this path. If you have a hard truth, that one that you have difficulty with, you've seen it incorrectly. Insight is always joyful. It always produces joy. But you have to have a calm mind so that you see things with the right state of mind to experience it as joyful. So there is no insight without calm, and there is no calm without insight. They are yoked together. When people say, oh, you get stuck in jhana, I don't think you should be worried about that, because you have to know the Dhamma and follow the Dhamma in order to get into jhana. And if you want jhana, that's a good way to make it not happen. So there's the jhanas, as I said before, are different from sensual pleasures, are of a different quality of sensual pleasure, should be cultivated, pursued, and developed precisely because they're not addictive, precisely because they're liberating. They liberate our awareness and allow us to see what is correctly. And when we see what is correctly, it produces joy. And then through the catharsis, through this constant cycle of arousal, bliss, contentment, refraction, through that constant cycle, we go deeper, that repeating cycle.
And where do we ultimately go?
we ultimately go away. The ego, all of our instincts, the 10 fetters, the basis instincts that we have that really cause us to crave to be here because they want something, this deep instinctual wanting, all of that goes away, and what's left, not us.
I like to see the jhanas as actually stages of insight, because I really, jhana means to come from the root di, which means like to see or to something, which was probably taken from the early Vedic tradition that the Buddha had. Sujata says it might be from the Gayatri Mantra that the priest recited a lot of that time. And basically you're actually learning how the mind works deeper and deeper and deeper. So the jhanas in my stages of insight, they're not like, you know, something you just do just fine. It's like, well, yeah, but
yeah. There's kind of a built into the jhanas a need for insight, or else you can't have them. They have to be learning experiences in order to have them.
I think that understanding that is very divisive comes from that kind of tendency to divide samatha and vipassana practice, say that vipassana is only the insight one, and the samatha is the jhanas, and it's only just like, you don't know anything, you're just like, you're not realizing anything at all. So I don't think that's really accurate. I think the jhanas are just like bringing us so much insight on our own minds. Like when you go into the arupa jhanas, you're understanding, wow, this is the mind and like how it works, and now it's starting to witness itself, and it comes up with all these things, and you have to kind of relax that and navigate.
You have to have experience in order to have insight. So touching upon knowledge with the body is experience, being a body witness. And then learning, knowing what that means, the significance of it, is insight. Without actually experiencing something that you know, it's called a speculation. The Buddha calls it hearsay. You didn't experience it yourself. You've heard it from somebody else. You've read it in a book. So the jhanas are touching upon states and understanding what they mean. There's no way to avoid understanding what they mean. That's part of their pleasure.
Do they map back to the 12 links of dependent origination?
Do the jhanas map back to the 12 links?
Like, as the deeper you get, the more the links you'd be able to see? Or?
Yeah, the jhanas aid in the understanding of the 12 links, mainly because the jhanas bring such tranquility to the mind, such carefulness to the mind, such equanimity to the mind, that you can see more refined links arising, right? Just like if it's perfectly still, you notice the tiniest movement. But when you're moving yourself, you don't notice tiny movements.